Just as the steam engine defined the 1800s, the internal combustion engine would come to be the defining invention of the subsequent century. Throughout the 1900s, the car and the motor vehicle would define the world around it, with cities being bulldozed and rebuilt to allow its passage. In the UK, we envisage the era of the motor car as being in the 1960s and 70s, but the foundation for that was laid in the 1920s and 30s. And here on today's episode of Rails to Nowhere, we will be exploring that underlying foundation of the era of the motor car. Hello and welcome back to Rails to Nowhere. My name, as ever, is Simon, and joining me for a second time is our guest co-host, Aaron. Hello, Aaron. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, everyone. Hello.
And today, I have dragged Aaron onto a ostensibly railway history podcast to come and talk about motor cars, because contrary to a lot of the literature that exists on public transport in the 1930s, I actually think the motor car had quite a significant impact on urban transport and London in this period. Today, we think a lot about the motor car boom being in the 1950s and the 60s, the motorways open post-war, so you've got the M1 and the M6 as the early motorways sort of launching in that period. But realistically, the car doesn't just appear out of nowhere in 1945 after the end of the Second World War. It has been a thing actually almost as long as trains. There have been internal combustion engine vehicles. And so on this episode, we're going to be talking about the history of the motor car and its spread in the UK. And in a couple of episodes' time, me and Ella will be talking about how the emergence of the motor car in the 1930s is actually influencing the urban geography of London, because I think it is very interesting how that works. So in the bonus episode that me and Ella produced back at the beginning of 2023, and which released at the beginning of this series for the free feed, we talked about the importance of historiography and the importance of understanding the sources that you're looking at and the limits of those. And this is certainly one of those areas where the historiography of urban transport is skewed and really lacking, because a lot of texts, so some important texts on this topic, just ignore the existence of the motor car. One of the big writers on the topic of London's urban history, certainly in the 70s and 80s, is Alan Jackson. And a lot of his texts do crop up again and again in this series' bibliographies. So we've got things like Semi-Detached London, Rails Through the Clay. And he really sets the baseline for a long time for the discussion of London's transport history. But he just ignores the existence of the car. In fact, he actually explicitly outright rules it out as an influence. He says, oh, I was a kid in the 30s and the 40s, and I don't remember really seeing very many motor cars, so therefore they weren't a thing, and therefore they're not important. But firstly, I mean, being a kid doesn't I remember many things from when I was a kid that aren't necessarily true. And more recent research by Michael Law has begun to suggest that actually the motor car is having an influence in London in the 1930s, maybe not because everyone's got one, because let's not pretend everyone's got a motor car in the 1930s, but the preparations, the expectation that the motor car is going to take off means there's changes in government policy, there's changes in what people want. You see people wanting houses where they could store a car, maybe with a garage or a drive, and this influences housing design. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a slightly later episode when we talk about the growth of Harrow and the 1930s suburb. But here we're going to talk about where the motor car comes from and how it becomes established as this sort of item of desirability, shall we say. So, Aaron, what do you know about the origin of the motor car?
Well, now that's putting me on the spot, isn't it? I think exactly what you're saying there is the idea that not everybody would have had a car by a long stretch, actually. Very few people would have been able to have or own a car in the 1920s and 1930s. No. But most certainly there were aspirations towards it. I mean, especially in the interwar period, people would have been interested in what was effectively new technology. Of course,
Yeah.
Internal combustion engine's been around for quite a few decades. But this kind of packaged consumerist kind of ideal is starting, I think, in that period.
Yeah.
And as you say, again, it's the government are looking towards, they tend in terms of transport to look towards modernity. And you can kind of see the seeds of that. There are talks of the need for certain rail extensions in the 30s because of the possibility that cars
have
very, very few lines, very few sentences, very few discussions, but it's there, and it's obviously much more prevalent later on.
Yeah, and I've certainly seen that in the primary sources I've looked at, especially around sort of Acton and Greenford Way, there's sort of references on it. So I think it'll come as no surprise to anyone that apparently you can attribute the internal combustion engine to the Chinese because they invented everything, I guess. But realistically, the internal combustion engine emerges as a usable thing that we'd recognise today in the 1800s. In the sort of mid-1800s, there's some toying around with it. We've got steam engines. Well, what if we could take these various flammable products from oil and use those to create some sort of internal combustion engine. So it's called an internal combustion engine because the combustion is inside the engine, as opposed to a steam engine, which is an external combustion engine because the combustion occurs outside of the engine and turns steam to make the pistons move.
I think the most prevalent, the most kind of, well, I mean, the most mass produced is Ford, isn't it?
As soon as we're going to get on to Ford in a few moments. But yeah, so through the 1800s, we see some developments. We see the first sort of moving vehicles emerging in the mid-1800s, very much just developments of steam engines, of replacements of the steam engine with crude petrol. Or they're not quite petrol, they're using slightly other products of oil at this point. And through the 1800s, we see an increasing variety of vehicles that look more and more like cars as we'd recognise them. In the UK, and as a former resident of Walthamstow, I have to bring this up, there is a strong claim to say that the first motor car in Britain is invented in Walthamstow in 1892 by Frederick Bremer.
Which incidentally is a school in Walthamstow now, isn't it?
It's named after him. If you're in the East London area, you can go to the Vestry House Museum and see, I can't remember if it's the original or a reproduction off the top of my head now, but they've got one there. We also see inventors such as Daimler and Bertha Benz creating their first vehicles in this era. Unlike Bremer, Daimler and Benz being names that we know to this day as manufacturers of vehicles, they're beginning to establish their companies in this era. But these are all, well, they're all one-off crafted items at this point. A car is, well, as with a lot of things at this point, like, yes, you've got mass production for many things, but even steam engines at this point are individually crafted things that you can't necessarily mass produce at this point. And so motor cars are very expensive. They're a luxury item, and this will come back to be very important in the story of how it becomes a desirable item through the 1910s and 20s. But yeah, they're a luxury plaything for the rich, and they get a bit of an air of mystery, and all turn heads. People will be interested in the new technology. And as you said earlier, there's always been that. There's always been that sort of people interested in the new stuff. If we think back to the emergence of the steam engines and the steam locomotives, they play very much off being the sort of new fashionable technology. If we look at the 1851 Great Exhibition, we can see steam engines, both static and mobile locomotives, being displayed as wonders of science there. And the Victorian era is very much a boom period for sort of the middle class and the upper class to be interested in scientific advance more generally. And we can also see in the later 1906 and 1924 British Empire exhibitions, exhibitions of steam locomotives as they're developing, notably, famously, Flying Scotsman displayed up in Wembley in 1924 for the British Empire exhibition. In addition, we can see growing interest and popularity and following of the development of cruise liners and the new airliners. So, for example, the Titanic and its kin being displayed as great feats of engineering, and the developing planes of the era also being sort of seen with fascination and interest because of their modernity and the new technology that they represent. And during the sort of late 1800s and the early 1900s, the car begins to be this brand new peak of technological invention, and it begins to become that sort of, oh, that's the thing that people should be fascinated by. And in the railway and in railway history, we talk about the Sparks effect and that drawing people in. And very much that's the same thing that's sort of happening here with the motor car, isn't it?
I think that's an interesting, the idea here is that they are, as you say, crafted products, products that are very expensive for, you know, the rich only, really. And that will drive fascination from the classes below that. It is that kind of move towards mass production that then brings it into the reach of people. And again, it's still a product that's not something, you know, that everybody could have. That doesn't happen for a long time, for decades later. But it's quite an interesting, whereas you kind of can get mass production going and almost this kind of continuation of consumerism as well, of changes in models and things like that. It becomes quite a, they craft it very much to become a consumerist item.
Yeah, exactly. And as we go into the 1900s, we begin to enter into that sort of more mass production era. Towards the 1800s, people had begun finding meaningfully productive uses for a internal combustion engine rather than just a plaything for the rich, because we have the first motor buses appearing in the late 1800s. And so through that period, through to the end of the First World War, the motor bus begins to take over. And I want to say it's the early 1920s or the late 1910s when all of London's motor buses are finally converted. Or sorry, all of London's buses are finally converted to motor buses instead of horse buses.
It's got to be around the end of World War One, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Probably 1920s. There's probably a delay. I'm just very guessing here.
Yeah, I feel like, if I'm remembering rightly, as you say, it's one of those things where the First World War interrupts the rollout, because a lot of buses, and the Transport Museum makes a good exhibition about how a lot of the buses get diverted across to France to help move troops around. So as ever, the First World War delays things, but then when, as we talked about in the last episode, when the war is over, people come back and they know how to drive motor buses and things like that. So they then lead to the boom in the expansion of the motor bus in the early 1920s. So this finding of practical uses for it means that there's suddenly an increased demand. And as we know from basic economics, supply and demand, if there's more demand, then the supply will go up as well. And therefore, people begin looking for ways to better produce them. And so, in 1908, you can't have a history of the motor car without talking about 1908, and as Aaron mentioned earlier, the launch of the Ford Model T, which is, it's arguable about whether this is actually the first mass-produced or first cheap car, but it's certainly the big one, and it's certainly got some of the biggest promotion and advertising behind it, and it is seen as heralding in the era of mass production of motor vehicles.
It's about marketing as well, isn't it? With
yeah,
with
absolutely.
Ford, they might not be the very first, but if you almost act as if you are, and you act as if you're the only option, I think that's where Ford is very clever.
Yeah,
that's where it drives the American market, the US market, and of course,
oh, absolutely,
you end up with production facilities in Britain not long after. I don't know the year exactly, but
yeah.
It's certainly acting as if they are the biggest. And there was obviously, there's other companies around at the time. But Ford, I think, if you say first mass-produced car, Ford is what comes to mind. The production line itself, the production process,
yes,
is revolutionised by Ford at that time.
Yeah, indeed. And the point about advertising and making it feel like you are the natural one and the biggest, again, harkens back to what we were talking about last episode about the UERL and its attitude to sort of making itself be the natural organisation to be the runners of the underground. And yeah, so Ford launches the Model T, and as you say, there's some tweaks and some improvements in the way you do production line. And that's really the very big thing with the Model T, is the production line and the much greater level of production that it allows than previous models had. And yeah, they launch in the States, and shortly later they launch in the UK, and being the excellent historian I am, I've forgotten to note on the script when it launches in the UK. I've got it as launching in 1908, which I believe is the US date, and I think it's a year or two. I think it's a year or two later, in like 1909, 1910.
I think the Manchester production facility is... I'm not sure whether they are producing cars from scratch, but the Manchester production facility comes in as well, which obviously brings
yeah.
that to the UK as well. I mean, obviously, it makes a much more
yeah.
Easily transportable product. Just having Look, Simon, just one sec, because Trafford Park, beside the Manchester Ship Canal, we'll cut this bit in. The first Ford to be sold in the UK was actually the Model A, launched in 1903 in the US. Obviously, the Model T is like the one. Yeah. I'm just trying to see when the need to invest massively in a high tooling. Yeah, and the former carriage works was assembling Fords by October 1911. So they were in the 1911, by now Ford's principal model was the Model T, and this was the car that was assembled at the new plot. So they began selling Model A's production facility in 1911. So that kind of bears out.
So yeah, so it's as we go into the 1900s that we begin seeing the expansion of mass production and cheaper vehicles. I think important to note that they're not cheap. We're still talking a couple of years worth of wages to buy one, which in fairness, if you want to buy a new car today, you're still sometimes looking at a year or two's worth of wages, even for some basic models. But we are talking about increasing mass production and a move away from the sort of craft handmade vehicles. We'll talk a little bit more about this in slightly later date, but this also heralds in one of the big influences of the motor car and the motor vehicle on the British cityscape, of course, which is brand new forms of factories, brand new industrial sites. As you say, we've got sites in Manchester. Ford very quickly established themselves in East London. They still to this day have a huge site down in Dagenham. And again, with motor buses, you have huge manufacturing sites being established through this period to produce these vehicles.
Heading into the 1930s, Ford's production plant in Dagenham effectively builds the entire town, Dagenham, because of the workers. So most of Dagenham is built up because of the large production facilities there, and most of the people were in the factory.
Yeah, and this is the really big thing with the motor car in this period. It's building, as you say, towns like Dagenham, places like Trafford Park in Manchester. And you look back in the 1800s and the railway works, places like Swindon and Crewe that we know of now as big places did not exist before the railways just went, well, that's a good field to stick a manufacturing facility in. And then the little village next door suddenly grows into this massive town feeding into the railways. And the motor car is doing the same again here. And additionally, this is an important period because there's a lessening of regulation in the UK as well. Because, of course, before this point, regulations on motor vehicles required it to go absurdly slow and have somebody with a red flag walking out in front of it and sort of like a warning people that there's this motor car coming. And that really limits the potential for their spread, because if you can only go slow enough for someone with a red flag to walk out in front of your vehicle, well, I don't know about you, Aaron, but I'm not going to go out using that as my day-to-day transport mode.
It makes it incredibly difficult, doesn't
yeah.
it? Yeah, it makes it. I mean, speeds and things like that are really interesting. I think it has great parallels as well with regulations today, how we're responding today to electric vehicles, self-driving vehicles, lots of the terminology and language around that, and where we are in Britain in terms of we're quite a slow nation, quite a slow country to change and adapt to these things now. But it feels like then that actually this seemed to be a lot quicker, and there was a lot more kind of rapidity in the way that they changed rules.
Yeah. So in this period, we see a shift in that legislation. We see a removal of the so-called red flag rules and the reduction in restrictions. And it leads to an interesting period where there's a reduction in regulations before some of the new regulations start coming in the 1930s with the growth of the motor car. But I think the fact that Parliament is being inspired to talk about this stuff and think about the motor car is important, because Parliament doesn't just do things for no reason. So the fact they're having an impetus to reduce these regulations suggests there is growing demand, maybe, and also growing interest and actually growing understanding. And then as we move into the 1930s, we begin seeing various things brought in. We see the Highway Code launched in the 1930s, driver's licenses come in the 1930s. We see the introduction of new road safety infrastructure. So things like the zebra crossing are introduced in the 1930s.
The traffic light, incidentally outside Parliament, which seems to happen.
Yes.
Quite often, anything like that has to be seen by the Parliament. So Yes, right outside.
Yeah, and very early on, they are with the name traffic signal. They look a lot like railway signals with arms that go up and down to indicate go, prepare to stop, and stop. And very early example, as you say, is put up outside Parliament so that people can see it, so the legislators can see it. And over time, these begin to develop into the multicolour lights that we recognise today as traffic lights. Hello, Simon here. Sorry for the brief interruption to the conversation. Just a quick shout out to say thank you to our fantastic patrons over at patreon.com/rails2nowhere. Our patrons help support the creation of Rails to Nowhere, contributing as little as just £2 per month to help fund the various costs that come with running even a small podcast like this one. In return, as a thank you for your generous support, me and Ella give you additional bonus episodes, a week's early listen to all of our normal episodes, and some extra early content and some extra content blogs. Otherwise, thank you for listening. Thank you to those of you who do support us. Thank you to those of you who are now thinking about supporting us. And let's return back to the conversation. And so this really sort of indicates that there is a growth in this. And as me and Ella talked about way back in episode one, following the First World War, there is a boom in the number of goods vehicles. By 1939, there are 500,000 motor goods vehicles registered on UK roads. Even more astonishing when you sort of look at these sort of texts that say there are no cars in existence. By 1939, there are 2 million cars registered on UK roads, which is not an insubstantial number. And especially when we're talking about the history of London, the vast majority of those are in the Greater London area.
But that's where it changes, isn't it? That's where the significance, I mean, what you said there about goods traffic, that obviously has an impact on the railways. But even companies, the company that comes to mind is Sainsbury's. In the period when technology was available, and technology being a truck that didn't involve having to have horses, they were there at almost at the forefront of it. They were able to invest in technology. It revolutionized or transformed their delivery market. You might see kind of pictures of horses and carts going around for quite some time, but they were using motor vehicle to expand their network outside of their Blackfriars headquarters. They were able to expand into the home counties, for example, and further beyond because of the Metropolitan Railway used to have a good traffic into Baker Street, and they used to use, or they did use, motor vehicles, trucks to get out further than their horse and carts could. So again, it's that driving the technology almost, if you like, and then the consumers come along afterwards. And 2 million cars is significant for that period, I think.
Yeah, and I think, again, with the sort of motor vehicles sort of getting goods and motor buses getting people to railways, it also features heavily in the advertising that they're fast and reliable and can go further and guarantee deliveries much better than a horse and cart do, and start drawing people in and being very much we're using or enabling the most recent technology. And with 2 million vehicles, 2 million cars, and a large number of motorcycles as well. So we're not just talking about cars, we're talking as well about motorcycles. We see a change in road design, because cars need subtle differences in road design versus horses and carts, not least because they can do greater speeds. And it's important not to ascribe every road scheme in this period to the motor car, because it's not. But if we look at how roads develop in this period, you can really sort of start to see how this is starting to influence things. Because starting in the 1800s, many roads in the UK, many of the longer distance roads, they're sort of turnpikes, they're sort of dirt roads. They're not seeing huge amounts of traffic, and you're having to pay a toll whenever you want to use them.
And one of the big, and I think unsung, advances in road design and road technology that happened in this period that is tied with increasing speeds and desires for better comfort on the road, of course, is things like tarmac, which provides a much smoother surface to the road than a dirt track or a cobbled road, and also provides easier and cheaper maintenance, longer lifespan to the road, which means that if you've got more vehicles travelling more quickly over the road. It provides a more hard-wearing, more comfortable surface for those vehicles. And it also provides a more cost-effective way for authorities to maintain large sections of road as well. We also see the advent of road markings in the early 1900s. So white lines, zebra crossings, as mentioned earlier. These all begin to appear, providing greater clarity for vehicles travelling at a greater speed. So you can see the information you need to see at a greater distance before you reach the location in question.
And at the beginning of the 1900s, we're seeing a variety of big road schemes occurring in a couple of places, but they're predominantly about creating sort of nice environs for people to be in and, yeah, relieving congestion from the horses and carts, but they're not about motor vehicles moving quickly between places. So I'm thinking things like the Kingsway scheme in London, which sees the road redeveloped to be a still pleasant place for people to be, but provide more capacity. But it's not a high-speed road as we'd recognise it today. But we see the introduction of schemes to create faster roads through the sort of 1920s and 30s. So we see the proposition for what eventually in the 60s becomes the ringways, but we see the beginning of trunk roads being developed. So routes like the Great Eastern Road, the A12 in East London, you go along that and you think, oh, it's a dual carriageway, it must be a modern road, but then you realise actually it's flanked on either side by 1930s buildings because that's when it's being designed. The North Circular, the first ideas for that begin circulating in the 20s and 30s. I've had a look at the plans for that through East London and the creation of the route across sort of the Lee Marshes. It begins in the 1920s. Pardon?
Abercrombie.
So this is pre-Abercrombie. This is in the... Yeah. So we think of the Abercrombie report and that sort of proposes what eventually becomes the ringways and the sort of really big concentric system of motorways that are proposed in the 50s and 60s. But this grows out of these 1930s proposals for bypasses and faster routes. Lots of cities like York are proposing bypasses at this point. A lot of these get interrupted by the Second World War, but the Lee Valley crossing in the North Circular is proposed and built in the 1920s. It's later expanded and changed through the 60s and 70s. And so we're seeing these changes in the physical infrastructure of the road to accommodate the increased flexibility of journeys offered by the car and the increased speeds of the car, and to try and adapt the roads to the usage of people using the motor vehicle.
That's the main thing, isn't it? Getting people and really utilising. I mean, the Kingsway scheme is great because it's this grand Parisian boulevard. It does involve multimodal kind of travel, trams, yep, and people and vehicles, obviously horse-drawn at the time. But it responds to the medieval roads or the much older roads of Drury Lane and Chancery Lane. That's something very different to enabling somebody to leave London and travel to another part of, yes, the country. And that's the distinction there, isn't it? These kind of roads that are designed to get you from one place to another without effectively, although lots of these roads even today go through villages and towns, they are designed to bypass those, and for you to be able to, the A12 is a great example, to be able to get to parts of the country faster, brought on by the fact you can drive there and you don't need to stop off. You don't need to stop off in villages and coaching inns and things like that. So it's that distinction, isn't it? It's those kinds of roads that enable travel, not just for, I suppose, principally it's about getting goods along those routes as well, but leisure travel can start to come about from that as well, although that will be a little bit later on, again, by people being able to own the vehicles themselves.
Yeah, although we are seeing leisure travel for sort of the middle class is beginning to be an option by the motor vehicle. But I think that's a really important point you've kicked on, is that routes like the Great Eastern and the Great Western Ways, which are built in this period in their initial forms, I'm aware the Great West Way gets really upgraded in the 1960s as part of the ringway schemes. But these early A roads are different from things like Kingsway, because Kingsway is about increasing internal communication within London. It's about improving the capacity for short local journeys. Things like the A12, the primary function of that is to enable interurban road travel. It's about letting people be able to drive in and out of the city in a way that really road transport hadn't provided interurban transport since pre the railways, because once the railways emerge, they are the fastest and most reliable way to go between urban centres. You look at travel times between major settlements pre-railways and you're talking days, weeks to get between major urban areas. So London to York is a couple of weeks, and further up into Scotland is even more time. And so when the railways come, that sort of interurban road transport just sort of dies, because why would you spend weeks travelling on a stagecoach to go to York when you can do it in a day by train? The emergence of the motor car begins to erode that dominance of the railway, because suddenly there's a vehicle that can sustain, yeah, it can only sustain at this point 20, 30 miles an hour rather than the 60, 70, 80 miles an hour that a modern motor car can sustain. But that does massively increase the range of distance you could travel in a day by road. And so, as you say, we get these roads like the A12 being constructed to allow people to drive out of London in a way that you couldn't have taken road transport out of the city before.
One of the things that strikes me is the government change, the red flag rule, that changes very quickly, and I think they respond yep. quite quickly. But then with the roads themselves, you know, I live in the Royal Docks, and one of my favourite little factoids about the Royal Docks is that the Silvertown Way, the flyover of Silvertown, is the oldest flyover in the country, or the very first one. You know, it was built in late 1920s to respond to the docks, and they referred to it as the kind of route to the empire. It was an incredibly significant route that was a few decades past the Kingsway scheme, and now it's responding to motor traffic, to accidents that are going on in that particular very small, very, very small nucleus of space. But it's so significant to the movement of goods, and there are people being injured. They're responding almost, you know, very quickly, but there's no grand plan that they thought of, how are we going to kind of respond to this? They actually respond quite ad hoc. And I feel like that's the development of these roads as well, schemes that are intercity. They take quite a long time. There's no prospectors coming along as there were on the railways to build big kind of the London and Birmingham, for example. There's none of that. It's all responding late. And it's government. And it's government here, not private.
Yeah, that's the really big difference between the, I'm going to say early roads, even though roads have existed, as we know, for a very long time. But the roads that are being developed in this period, the really big difference with the railways, of course, as you say, is it's the state that's doing the work. The government is building these trunk roads. And as you say, they are trying to respond to safety concerns. As I mentioned earlier, you get the Highway Code in 1937. The driving test comes in 1935. Although at that point, it's basically nothing compared to what we do now for a driving test. And there are attempts to make the road safer, but a lot of these involve introducing the sort of segregations that we view as natural today, but at the time were very unnatural, because back in the 1920s, the idea that you could just like take a stroll down the middle of the road, well, when things are moving along at the speed of a crowd of horses and carts, you're fine, mostly, unless you stand right in front of a horse bus, to sort of be walking down the middle of the road while the horse buses and horse trams are sort of trundling around you. As motor cars become faster, a little quieter, we begin seeing an increased number of deaths on the roads. And responses vary in different places. In the UK, we get moves to have more delineation between the pavement and the road. You get pushes for segregated cycle lanes on busy roads. You get, as I said earlier, the creation of the zebra crossing and sort of generic road markings. Indeed, zebra crossings are still marked to this day by what we know as Belisha beacons, which are named after Leslie Hall Belisha, who was the Transport Secretary at the time. You get the introduction of your MOT test, or your Ministry of Transport test, in the 1920s and 30s. We don't go quite as far as the States. In large parts of the States, there is a massive publicity campaign by a lot of those interested in the motor car lobby to push against what they term as jaywalking, which is still to this day a offence in a number of US states, which basically means if you're on the road outside of a designated crossing point, that's considered to be an offence, and therefore you can be fined or even in some cases arrested for that. And these are all pushed as ways to make people safe, but realistically it's about sort of the motor industry allowing the motor car free rein and to take over the city, which you see a lot of pushback against that now, with a lot of people sort of now pushing for greater accommodation for cyclists and walkers and stuff like that. And as I'll touch on with Ella in a couple of episodes' time, we see massive changes to the urban landscape. You see, as I mentioned earlier, new housing is emerging in this period. So we're seeing this as the emergence of the sort of semi-detached house. And with that, we see an increasing number of driveways and garages and accommodations for motor vehicles to be parked. Because even if people aren't all owning a car yet, it's part of the dream. It's the Sparks effect is playing. People want the modern technology. They want the new boys' toy, so to speak. And that really indicates, I think, that the motor car is really beginning to take over in this period and beginning to see the groundwork laid for the large-scale adoption of the motor car that takes off in the post-war period.
It's very clever marketing, isn't it? Because it's all about who would want to sit on a, you know, a lot of these references are who would want to sit on a train and with other people. You can be in your own private space. There's not really any, it's all about the private, isn't it? It's this dream of being able to be in your own space. You can buy your own home, be in your own space there. You're not living necessarily in conditions, and this probably comes in slightly later, but you're not living in conditions with other people. You can have your own home, you can have your own land around it, and you can be in your own vehicle and you can get into work and not have to be around. You know, the train is seen as very kind of public and very exposing
and very regimented and very much an extension of you being told what and how you can live your life. If you live in rented accommodation, where you have limitations from your landlord, if you get the train where you're limited by the timetable, you get a car or a motor vehicle, motorbike, whatever, you're suddenly free to live life how you want to without any sort of direction from a higher authority. As the saying goes, an Englishman's home is his castle, and your motor car is the extension of your home beyond the physical bounds of your estate. And so this really lays the groundwork for the boom in motor travel that happens in the post-war period. This episode has only been quite short, but I think it has been an important one because I think it's important to understand where the motor car comes from, how it develops, and that actually it does develop and that it's not absent. But yeah, so that brings us to the end of what I've got down for us to discuss today. Next episode, hopefully Ella will be back and we will be talking about the development of Victorian suburbia and how the railways created the suburb and the commuter as we recognise them, even if they didn't create the idea of commuting. And in a couple of weeks' time, we will be returning back to this topic, me and Ella will, where we will be talking about how the suburb developed during the 1920s and 30s as a result of the emergence of the motor car on the roads of London and other cities. But for now, it's just thank you to Aaron for joining me for this episode again.
Thank you very much.
And a reminder to follow the podcast on Twitter and Instagram. We are at Rails to Nowhere on Twitter and on Instagram. But otherwise, a thank you and a goodbye, and we'll see you at the next episode. This episode of Rails to Nowhere was presented by myself, Simon Sardson-Co, and featured the voice of guest Aaron Oliver. Rails to Nowhere is produced by Simon Sardson-Co and Eleanor Ashton, and research for this episode was carried out principally by myself, with contributions from Aaron. Rails to Nowhere is brought to you by our fantastic patrons over at patreon.com/railstonowhere, especially those who subscribe at our £10 and above Patreon level. Thank you very much, Valkyrie Lemons.
If you'd like to support the creation of the podcast for as little as £2 per month, then you can do so over at patreon.com/RailsToNowhere. Otherwise, you can keep up with Rails to Nowhere over at twitter.com/RailsToNowhere or search Rails to Nowhere podcast over on Instagram. Until next time, thank you for listening and have a good day.